Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
Welcome to the Unforgiving 60. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host, Ben Pronk.
Timothy.
Before we start this episode, we might just reflect on the last with Nick Caldwell. Building elite performance from the weight room to the boardroom. Thoughts?
We were in the weight room. I really enjoyed that. We normally record in a studio. I reckon it was a much cooler environment to record in.
Yeah, no, it was fantastic being surrounded by all those implements of torture.
Which we both vaguely remember from our dim, dark past. Look, I thought it was a great chat. I actually really enjoyed the chat with Nick. I've known Nick for a long time, but I guess not well, and it was really fantastic to get a better understanding of his story. I actually had come into his squadron just as he was had made that decision to stand down. So he was suffering at the sort of nadir of his chronic fatigue, and so I was aware of Nick, but I just had no idea of the struggle. And we talk a lot about, you know, a little further. We are the Pilgrim's Master. We shall go always a little further. I mean, you couldn't encapsulate that better than Nick's journey. Imagine just being so, your dreams are dashed, you know, everything you've worked for in your life has basically been taken away from you. But having that drive to just one foot in front of the other, you know, I'm going to spend half an hour awake today, tomorrow I'm going to spend 35 minutes, and then to build that up into where he's at the moment, awe-inspiring.
Did you know he's never publicly told the story about his chronic fatigue syndrome?
I did not.
Yeah.
Well, I feel doubly touched there.
It was so it was quite difficult for him to recount that story, and we're very glad he did, because I'm sure there are other sufferers out there of chronic fatigue and other things who take inspiration from Nick.
Yep.
For a guy who was in the SAS regiment and affected by chronic fatigue, and you know the tempo of the unit and what you're expected to do from sun up to sundown, quite incredible that with chronic fatigue, he was able still to going. Do all of that and of course, deliver good results on operations.
And you'd probably remember from your CrossFit days, dim, dark past, a Finn called Mikko Salo, who won the CrossFit Games in, I want to say,
2019.
Yeah, back in the day. But he'd talk about this this Finnish concept of sisu, S-I-S-U, which is just this idea of never giving up. And there was an interviewer who asked him at one stage, you know, why don't you lie down exhausted at the end of a tough workout? You know, you're always on your feet. And he responded something like an animal in the wild, when they lie down on their back, that means they've given up and they're ready to die. And he never wants to be in that position. I reckon that really resonates, that idea of whatever the opposite of victimhood is, you know, being able to continue going regardless of what's happening to you. Certainly, Mikko Salo encapsulated that back in the day, and I think we've seen a great example of that in Nick Caldwell's story.
And what courage to make the decision to disengage from the unit, recognising that he was a liability to himself and, more importantly, to the team.
Yeah, moral and physical strength.
Yeah, fantastic. And we dissected a little bit of that human performance, and not surprisingly, he echoed Tim Jack Adams on, you know, the things that you've got to do to become healthy and fit.
Yep.
And the first one was be mindful. Yep. Think about what you did today. Think about all the things you're grateful for. Get out of bed. Get your feet on the ground. Turn around and make your bed. All of those small things that then start to create time and headspace to do some exercise.
Yeah. I was disappointed that my morning routine wasn't exactly what he recommended, hitting snooze 14 times and sleeping through my workout. But there's hope for me yet, I suppose.
I have to put my alarm clock out of reach, so I physically have to get out of bed in order to turn it off.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that.
But thanks again to Nick. And if you haven't heard that particular episode with Nick Caldwell, circle back. Fantastic stuff. Let's get on with the show. 21 years ago, police officer Jason Semple was a brand new rookie cop at a police station in Annandale, New South Wales, Australia, when Constable Peter Forsyth invited him and a colleague, Brian Neville, out for a welcome beer. That same night, four teenagers, two boys and two girls, were in the same area. That group included Murray Hearn. The group approached the off-duty cops just before 11:30 p.m., offering to sell them drugs. The off-duty police officers couldn't believe that young people were trying to entice three grown men who they didn't know into buying drugs. What happened next ended a life and a career. Murray Hearn stabbed Jason Semple. At first, Jason, the rookie cop, thought he'd just been punched. He had no idea both he and his mate, Constable Peter Forsyth, had both been stabbed and that one of them was about to die. Jason Semple joins us today to discuss this extraordinary story of survival and growth. Welcome to The Unforgiving 60. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host Ben.
G'day.
And as we explained in the introduction, we're joined by Jason Semple today. Hi, Jason.
Hi there, guys. Thanks very much for having me on the program.
Welcome to the show. So in the introduction, we've explained the circumstances of that horrendous evening some 21 years ago. But before we get to that incident, could you outline the circumstances of maybe your early years and entering the police force?
Yeah, no problem at all. Like a lot of people that join our services, whether it's police or military, you know, when you either go straight out of school or you sort of find your feet, so to speak, trying to figure out what you want to do. I actually had applications in for the police and the military at the same time. I was at the tail end of doing a five-year traineeship in mechanical engineering at the same time as well. But I suppose due to my requirement for a bit of adventure and something different, I just didn't want to get cooped up in an office doing engineering for the rest of my life. You know, I looked towards something that would, you know, scratch that itch, being military or police and also community service. At the time, you know, the military were obviously reasonably busy, but, you know, it was just prior to a lot of the events that would keep our military, you know, in the fight for many years. So I ended up sliding into the police at the completion of that traineeship. I started in 97. And basically from the very beginning, I ran into guys from our tactical operations unit down when I was at the police academy. So it was like fortuitous, you know, that where I'd end up later on in my career in policing. It literally started from the very first week down at the academy, running into guys in the gym. And, you know, I a lot of stuff has to do with fate. And, yeah, it's quite amazing, you know, where that's taken me. Once I graduated from the academy, once again, it was a fortuitous day because it was actually Friday the 13th in 1998. Mm. Yeah, I was positioned at Annandale Police Station in inner city in Sydney, which was in the process of being taken over by, you know, the superstation. So we ended up being Glebe, Annandale, Leichhardt, Balmain. So basically I worked in that area. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I'd only been in the job for 2 weeks when that incident happened.
So perhaps talk us about, let's turn our attention to the incident. You'd been, you know, a badged uniform police officer and in the station for 2 weeks when you were invited out for a welcome beer by some of your colleagues. Can you talk us through that evening?
Yeah, so that evening, you know, like you said, I was on a sort of an odd shift of 9 a.m. till 9 p.m. We picked up Peter Forsyth, who obviously, you know, was later to lose his life that evening, and dropped him off at an airport for a prisoner run, they call it, in the police, where they escort prisoners to and from establishments around the state. During that process, Pete's obviously said, Jace, one of the new guys in the station, when we're really happy to have another big guy, you know, working in plain clothes, in uniform in the police at the time, and was really keen to just sort of get to know me and, you know, said, we should catch up for a beer. It helped that the guy I was working with that shift was, you know, one of his really close mates, Brian Neville. So, yeah, we sort of acknowledged that as soon as he got back and we finished our shifts, we would sort of link up and have a beer at one of the inner city pubs, which ended up being down the street from his house at Ultimo.
Okay. And the beers having been drunk and you walked out on the street and you're approached by a small group of teenagers.
Yeah, that's correct. On one of the few occasions where I actually drank light beer to, I suppose, give the impression that I was, you know, doing the right thing and early days in the police, of course. Yeah, so once we'd left the pub, obviously, you know, we were approached by Murray Hearn and some other of his associates, and he offered us, the sale of ecstasy at the time, just a single pill. Also wearing half uniform, so I was still wearing my police pants, police boots, you know, just had a T-shirt on over that uniform. So it's to all and sundry, you know, you should have been readily identifiable as a police officer, but I suppose people in their desperation, they don't sort of always identify those little aspects.
Mm. Did you produce your badge when they offered you the ecstasy?
No, I didn't, because I was so identifiable wearing literally 2/3 of my police uniform. And then the way in which we engaged ourselves with him, you know, it was quite clear to everyone that we were police, including his demeanour once he realised that where the conversation piece was going.
Mm.
You know, it's very clear the way we speak, you know, as police, you know, especially once, because there's so much formality involved when you go through an arrest procedure. He was in no doubt we were police, and we picked up on the fact that he picked up on that, and it was just going through the process of then working out what we were going to do with him as an offender, and, you know, obviously get a local car crew to come down and pick him up, arrest him and deal with him.
And little did you know that one of those four teenagers, Murray Hearn, was carrying a concealed weapon.
Yeah, that's correct. So, you know, Murray was carrying a buck knife, and realistically, you know, in hindsight, we've talked about this at great length with a number of people since the incident. If he hadn't have stabbed myself and Pete that night, you know, there is no doubt in our mind that he was on a collision course with just wanting to stab someone, and we were probably the first real opportunity that presented. You know, apparently there was he had a bit of history for producing knives, and also there's anecdotal evidence of him practicing and training with them as well.
So you described the sensation when he used the knife like being punched. Could you talk us through that sensation?
Yeah, sure. Once we had had control of Murray, who's the offender, and his younger brother, we put them in an alcove, so they didn't have much room to move laterally, and we could concentrate on just that forward aspect of dealing with them. It's one of those things I've never in my policing career, I always treated every single event after this one as having the capacity to go bad, because at the end of the day, that's policing, you know. Anyway, in this instance, obviously, we felt reasonably comfortable because it was three of us, police, and we had Murray on his haunches. When we were asking him to produce the identification that he had on his person, he's taken an opportunity to produce the knife. I thought he was actually just pushing away from the wall, and that he had struck me a couple of times, once in the stomach and chest. And I actually was thinking to myself, is that the best you got? And basically pushing back up against the wall by his neck. Little did I know that I'd been stabbed once in the stomach area and once in the chest, and Pete had actually been stabbed twice with the blade semi-exiting his chest. So it's actually two stab wounds where the blade doesn't come all the way out. During that process, Brian Neville, who's the third police officer, you know, there and one of my good mates, has seen the knife and caught it and pushed both myself and Pete away from the offender. At that point, you know, Brian's basically in a standoff with him, and he's tried to, obviously, he's weighing up whether to try to stab Brian, and then they've had a foot chase with Brian's chased him down the road. But, you know, at a point when Brian's a bit further down the street, he's looked back, and I think he expected to see us either behind him, but in fact, we were right back where the scene of the incident was and both lying on the ground. So, you know, his immediate thoughts were, we can catch up with the offender later, and I need to get back up to the boys and see what's happened.
A quick interlude. Jason and his partner Peter have now both just been stabbed in the street with a Bowie knife. They start to lose blood, and quickly. What are the life-saving skills that could be used in this situation? Here's Dr. Dan Pronk, ex-Special Forces doctor, to describe self-help and buddy help for a stab wound.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. So we hear of this Dr. ABC, people will have heard of that, I imagine. That's danger, response, airway, breathing, circulation. So that first part, danger, is that situational awareness. Try not to become a casualty yourself. If you are the casualty, try to minimize further injuries, get yourself to a place of relative safety. And that's crucial before you can move on to any real response. So after that, and in these trauma scenarios, the acronym MARCH tends to be more useful, I think, than the ABCs. And the MARCH there stands for massive hemorrhage first, with the M, or massive bleeding, and then airway, respiration, circulation, and you get down to your H with your head injury, hypothermia. But the first thing here that's really going to kill someone, particularly in the stab wound scenario, is massive bleeding. So a person, if they've got a severed artery, will bleed out and die in a matter of minutes. So you've got maybe 3, 4, 5 minutes from a decent stab wound that might have severed a big artery. So you want to get onto that massive bleeding as quickly as you can. So look, that's going to be a bit of a scramble in the street scenario, but direct pressure to a wound, if you can compress it, is the best way to start if you don't have any higher order kit with you. And so just pushing on that wound, or getting a clump of clothing together, a t-shirt, something like that, tied tightly around it and pushed on it, if it's a wound you can get to. So when we talk about massive hemorrhage, we break it down into two broad categories there. You've got compressible bleeds and non-compressible bleeds. So the compressible stuff, as it sounds, it's stuff you can get to and push on. It's on the arms, it's in the groin, maybe the armpits, the legs, so things you can access, the neck, the scalp. When we get to the non-compressible stuff, it gets a bit more challenging. So this is stuff like in the abdominal cavity, in the belly, in the chest, in the pelvis, stuff that you can't put a direct pressure on. And, you know, in this sort of instance where there's been a stab wound to the chest, that can be a real challenge. And there's not much you can do to compress that bleeding in the pre-hospital setting, even with expert equipment. So if you can get to a bleed, you want to compress it and push on it. Wrap something around it, lean on it tightly, kneel on it. The patient won't thank you, but it's life-saving. The next key thing to do is send for help. So if you're the victim yourself, you need to get on your phone and call an emergency line, be it a 000 or 911, whatever your regional line is. And if you're the first responder, you can do that and have it on speakerphone while you are responding and talking to the person on the other end, who will guide you through further management and let them know what's going on. So you want to send for help early. You don't want to get too bogged down, particularly if someone's bleeding away on you, then every minute counts there. You need to get them to higher medical care. Otherwise, they're going to die very quickly if they've got arterial bleeding. So send for help early. You want to control that massive hemorrhage. Then you start to move on to things like airway. So if you come across a casualty who is unconscious from bleeding, then, or for any reason, you need to try and establish an airway there. And so simple maneuvers, if you know them, like jaw thrust, chin lift, or just the recovery position most people are familiar with, to open up that airway to allow them to breathe if they're going to. You move down then onto respiration. So, I mean, coming back to the stab wound to the chest, this can introduce a number of injuries inside the chest there that can cause complications. But one that will be quite obvious is a thing called an open pneumothorax, or a sucking chest wound. And what that means is exactly as it sounds. The actual side of the chest, there'll be a hole there that goes through the skin, through in between the ribs, and it's punctured a lung. And what you end up with is sucking and blowing out the side of the chest wall. And so that hole there that's punctured the lung, what it causes is inappropriate of movement through the side of the chest wall that goes to a space around the lung, and it's not actually getting into the lung. So in effect, there's just air moving in and out. It changes all the pressures of breathing and stops the air going effectively into the lungs. And so one thing you can do in a stab wound to the chest scenario is occlude that. So put a hand over it, put something occlusive over that hole in the chest, stop it sucking and blowing, and that will allow the good lung, if there is one, if both lungs haven't been damaged, to start actually drawing in some air and pulling some oxygen out of the air there, and keep that casualty going. But with any of the non-compressible bleeds, coming back to that, if they've been stabbed in the chest, abdomen, pelvis, something you can't compress, it's time to hire medical care that's going to save them there. So that's a really quick emergency call. Get the ambulances inbound. Do your best to compress whatever you can. Cover any sucking chest wounds. Keep that person calm, or if you're the person, try and minimize any movement in particular if they've been injured around the chest, abdomen, moving them around might just dislodge clots, cause all sorts of problems, and then get them off to hospital because the thing that's going to save them is blood transfusion and surgery. So they're the key things when you're approaching any trauma scenario, particularly a stab wound.
So at this point, you'd collapse, Jason. Had it sunk in, obviously, you've seen the blood, you've recognised this wasn't just a punch. What were your thoughts at that stage?
Yeah, well, it's like even to this day, the actual feeling of fear and the enormity of the situation, I can still feel it. It's very palpable, even 21 years later. But basically, once my brain had caught up with my body, and I looked down and I actually pulled my shirt up, like, you know, almost a it's almost childlike. You know, I lifted my shirt up to see what I knew was already occurring, and I obviously had quite a lot of blood coming out of my especially my abdomen. I've basically put my hands on that, and Pete's helped me to the ground. The you can get reassurance, but you know, we've all seen the movies and we've all given people reassurance, even when we know that it's just making them feel good. So for me, it was, you know, I was laying in that position, and the fear is palpable. And, you know, for me, it was a case of, you know, when they say your life flashes before your eyes, I think it does, but I think it's more your brain. I've tried to explain it a few times over the years, where your brain is like a hard drive, and it searches that hard drive in an instant, trying to figure out, okay, I'm in this situation and it's really, really bad. What can I do to overcome it?
Mm.
And you know, you then latch onto whether it's training or if it's, you know, even just some real anecdotal thing that someone has said to you over the years. It's amazing what you latch onto.
And what was that you latched onto at that stage?
Well, for me, I sort of, I was tuning out. At one stage, Pete had also, you know, literally, I thought he'd fainted on me.
Hmm.
You know, but, you know, at that point in time, you know, and you're in a lot of shock, you have to understand as well.
Yeah.
Pete had actually passed away. He was still, to a degree, having a minor pulse, but, you know, Brian obviously got up to him at this point, pulled him off me. Our legs were tangled, so the next thing you know, I feel is Brian giving... you know, resuscitation to someone who I thought had just sort of fainted. Because I'm thinking to myself, he was so calm and collected when he was talking to me about just, you know, take it easy, everything be okay, was the last thing he said to me. And there was no blood on Peter at all either, just due to the nature of his injury.
Right, completely internal.
Completely internal, yeah. So, you know, I'm confused as to what's happening with Pete, and then I'm trying to battle with my own just, like, it's almost insurmountable amount of fear, because the amount of that I was losing and watching, I was watching a river of it just cascade off the path I was on into the gutter at the time. And I was thinking, well, you can't survive this. This is, so getting back to your earlier question on what did I cling to? It was amazingly the night before I was reading a book about Mick Drury, who got shot. And I'm sure a lot of your viewers or your listeners are aware of the Blue Murder series in New South Wales policing history.
Yes.
Mick got shot by an unknown hitman back in the 80s. He was shot twice with basically a 44 Magnum through his kitchen window. But I was reading his book the night before. I was putting his book down and I thought, nah, it's just at the chapter that was getting interesting where obviously he got shot. So I thought, you know what, I'll just read this last chapter. And in that chapter, you know, Mick talks about when he got shot, he made sure his family got to their bedroom and what he thought would be safety. And he laid in his kitchen bleeding profusely, knowing he couldn't do anything for himself from a medical point of view, except maybe calm down, in which case he mightn't bleed as much. So that's what he concentrated all the way through to when he went into surgery on just remaining calm, and just literally to the point where he blocked out people asking him questions. So basically you know, that's lucky for me, it was the last thing I actually read apart from, you know, anything at work that day. And that's what I clung to. So I did the same thing. I just tuned out to the point where, you know, there was a lot of assistance going to Pete, and I just concentrated on my own world at that point. And yeah, like I said, to the point when people were coming up and trying to talk to me, and I was basically, you know, excuse the language, but saying, can you fuck off? You know,
I'm concentrating on staying alive here.
That's right. I've got the rest of my life to work this out.
Yeah.
How much blood did you lose?
It's funny, the early days, it was 4.9 litres of blood was the talked about amount. And I suppose you've got to take into account that once paramedics turn up, you know, you've got some fluids going back in. But, yeah, 4.9 litres was the banded literage that I lost during the episode. Later when I talked to the surgeon, he's like going, oh, to this day, I actually have no idea, you know, your fitness. And the muscle, he goes, anything could have sent you over the edge and, like, been lethal at that point. So I suppose Mick Drury probably saved my life.
That's brilliant.
A second interlude. Jason has lost 4.9 litres of blood. Here's Dr. Dan Pronk again on the probability that Jason should have survived given these circumstances.
So when it comes to looking at blood loss, it's often useful to consider the volume of blood lost as a percentage of the overall blood volume. And this is what we use medically to calculate what we sort of term as our stages of shock, classes of shock that I'll come back to in just a minute. But as a rough rule, an adult will have a blood volume of about 7% of their body weight. And so if you think about that in perspective, a 70 kilo adult will have a blood volume of about 5 litres, 100 kilo adult about 7 litres. And we're talking about lean mass there, not taking into account any additional sort of overweight factors. But so 5 to 7 litres between 70 and 100 kilos is a rough volume. Now that can vary individually, and it can also be altered with factors such as fitness. So athletes might have a blood volume of 15-20% higher, for instance. So it does vary, but that's a rough figure, 7%, to think about when you're calculating blood volume for an adult. So once we start losing significant amounts of blood, the body goes into a compensatory state known as shock. And so what's happening here is it's an evolutionary thing that allows the body to start shunting the blood away from non-essential organs and muscles and the skin and what have you, and shunting it towards the essential stuff. So keeping your heart, your lungs, your brain, your other vital organs such as your liver, your kidneys that do all the blood filtration and what have you. And it will sequentially shut down flow to the non-essential stuff as you continue to lose blood and you go deeper into shock. And at the ultimate state of shock, you'll just end up with the really core functions of your body running. You'll even go out of consciousness because it'll start to decrease the blood flow to your brain as you try and preserve the heart and lungs, the really key critical functions that keep you alive. So as you go into shock, you start to breathe faster, and that's the body trying to just get as much oxygen as it can into the remaining circulating blood. Your heart will start beating much faster as it's trying to pump the remaining blood around the system quicker to try and deliver that oxygen. And so you get all these compensatory mechanisms as you go into shock. So as I was talking about before, from a medical perspective, we talk about four classes of shock. And so they're rough amounts, there's categories, but up to and including class four, which is the worst. And we consider that once you've lost about 2 liters of blood. And so that's when patients are starting to really show some compensation. Their body's starting to struggle. They've had a significant loss. And these patients will almost universally need blood transfusion, replacement of that blood. And so once we start talking, so that's over 2 liters gets you into the highest classification of shock when we're talking about it from a medical perspective. In this scenario, we're talking about somewhere in the order of 4, 4.5, 5 liters of blood. And so to put some perspective on that, for anyone who's ever given a unit of blood, you go in there and you sit there for 10 minutes or what have you, and they suck out a unit of blood, that's about 450 mils, give or take, that they'll take from you. So when we look at a blood loss of 4.5 to 5 litres, we're talking about you sitting there and having 10 to 11 units of blood drained out of you at once. That's the kind of perspective that this kind of injury, that we can put on this kind of injury. So it's a real dire situation. And in this sort of scenario, once they reach hospital, if they reach hospital, we start to go into what we call a massive transfusion protocol. And as that name suggests, it's when we need to replace huge amounts of blood in relatively short periods of time. So by definition, a massive transfusion protocol is when you're transfusing more than 10 units of blood within about a 24-hour period, or roughly replacing the body's entire blood volume within a 24-hour period. And so that's very much what we start to look at doing with these huge blood losses. The studies for massive transfusion protocols in the literature consistently show that anyone who needs one of these MTPs, their survivability is 50% at best. So they'll consistently, 50% of them will die from their injuries or die during the transfusion process or secondary to their body just shutting down and not being redeemable even with massive transfusion. So the other consequence of having one of these huge bleeds is that your body is frantically trying to clot that blood and stop the bleeding. And what this can do is send the body's clotting mechanism a little bit haywire. So you can initially deplete all your body's clotting capability as your body frantically tries to clot an ongoing bleed. But then you can also get this sort of this haywire swing back in the wrong direction, and your body can start inappropriately clotting. So you get clots where you don't want them. So it just throws everything out of whack with your body's clotting mechanisms, which can complicate things if you end up with blood clots in your lungs and these kind of things. It can be a real disaster, and that can actually kill people in this scenario. So it's not just the blood loss, it can be this inappropriate clotting. The other thing to bear in mind, because your body does use all these clotting factors, is you need to replace them as well. And there's a very delicate ratio of replacing blood and clotting factors that you have to get right for an optimal outcome here. Even if you get that right, all of this change to the body's physiology and biochemistry upsets the electrolyte balance. And so you need to very carefully look at that and delicately balance the electrolytes while you're doing a massive transfusion protocol, or an electrolyte imbalance can potentially kill a patient who's very fragile by this stage anyway. And even if you get all of that right, there's a whole other range of transfusion reactions that can be life-threatening, and they include things like immune system responses to the blood, which has come from someone else, and there's all components within the blood that can cause an immune reaction, up to and including life-threatening lung issues and a range of other things. So there's, once you start to get into those huge amounts of blood loss needing these massive transfusion protocols, there's a range of things that really stack the odds against you for surviving. So all in all, surviving a blood loss of 4 to 5 liters, as we're seeing in this case study, is truly remarkable, and it's a real testament to both the grit and the fitness of the patient in this instance, but also the expertise of the treating team there to get that right and be able to pull this bloke back from the brink. So it's a huge effort all around.
And one of the cruel and evil twists is that the attack occurred very close to Peter Forsyth's family home, where he and his wife and kids were sleeping. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, literally, you know, about 140 metres away from his front door. Yeah, so very close to home, which is pretty much why, police inevitably, and, you know, the military are no different. There's a sense of duty and service. So, you know, for us, we don't sort of turn a blind eye to things, but they're, it's when it's so close to home for him, it was a no-brainer that he'd want to take action and make sure that, you know, people aren't selling drugs in a residential street.
It's very personal. And that's the alternative, isn't it? That you could have laughed it off as being a hoax once you identified the fact that it wasn't ecstasy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, at the time we you know, later in court it was determined that it was actually a Panadol pill. So, you know, you're talking about someone losing their life over not even a illegal substance. I mean, selling a Panadol and saying it is a ecstasy pill still equates to the same charge in the end anyway. It's still dealt with the same. But realistically, he wouldn't have even got a criminal record out of it. So it's, you know, it's quite clear that he had a mind frame that was in that ultra-violent category, and it didn't matter why we were trying to detain him. He just wanted to, to stab some, have some notoriety.
And I guess it comes back to that point you just made, Jason, about that sense of service and sense of duty to something bigger than yourself, and, you know, these ideas of the thin blue line, the people who will actually stand up and confront that kind of situation rather than just turn a blind eye and walk away. Mm. It speaks volumes for the kind of people that you guys were on that day, and obviously that Peter Forsyth was.
Yeah, that's, yeah, and it happens all the time. And I mean, the downside to, you know, you're still required, you know, with your oath as a police officer to react. And but, you know, obviously off duty, you just, you know, unless you're quite skilled with your, you know, your defensive tactics and your ability to fight, it really, you've got none of your tools of your trade. So it really is, you know, it really is a risky business because generally the people you're coming up with, you know, the criminals are armed with the same stuff they are all the time, as opposed to you being,
some of the time.
Yeah.
I mean, threat has two parts. The first part is intent. The second part is capability. And you described, you know, clearly Murray Hearn had the capability, had a knife, and he had the intent. He always had intended to stab someone. And the journey over a Panadol is kind of interesting. How long did it take for emergency services to get there?
Yeah, it's, well, when you get time to sort of break down, you know, occurrences over the years, and I'm sure you guys would have done it with a lot of the ticks you're in over the years as well. But, you know, I find it amazing all the background to what happened and all these little things that add up that allow you to survive that are totally independent of each other, you know. So for us, luckily that night, two of the paramedic wagons had people that had been deployed overseas in various roles, whether it was with the military or other areas with medical activities. So they wanted to catch up. So they caught up literally around the corner. And we had two really experienced paramedic, you know, buses ran, like literally joining on the spot. So, you know, if it had been your average Friday night, you know, especially leading into Mardi Gras where everyone's busy, it might have taken a while for some people to get to us. But for us, they're literally straight around the corner. So within a minute or two, we had people of high caliber working on us. And it's just amazing, you know, when you think about those conversations, do you want to catch up and meeting halfway from where they were both working that night, then leading to potentially that allowing me to survive because I get literally immediate first aid. And you guys know better than anyone how important that
getting those first couple of minutes. Yeah. Jason, so thinking back, 1997, before mobile phones, how were they actually alerted?
Basically by Pete yelling at the top of his lungs in the street to call police.
Triple O.
And same with Brian Neville. And we literally, you know, the commotion brought the locals out very quick. And the locals there are fantastic too. You know, they really, you know, for years have been big supporters of police. And I think they felt that it was a slight against them individually as well that this occurred in their residential area. So, like, really amazing people. And they obviously alerted police.
Excellent. So look, you've had this incredibly traumatic experience. It's essentially put your career on hold 2 weeks in, and not only the physical impact, but it must have had a massive psychological impact. Can you talk to us how you came back from there to get to where you are today?
Yeah, well, you know, the mechanics of that, we probably need a few programs to get through the... you know, but like a lot of people that have had a very traumatic experience like that, it was one foot in front of the other, basically. You know, when I woke up the morning after surgery, I was obviously, like everyone that's ever had surgery, it's, you're confused where you are. And then it dawned on me, oh, I'm actually still alive. And I, like, the elation was amazing, which then turned into grief because it was like, then you realize, and guilt, that you were so happy about something and on the flip side, someone else had passed away, you know, so.
And you knew at that stage that Peter had passed?
Yeah. I mean, I was shielded from it for as long as they could, but, you know, at the end of the day, you can ask the same question, how's Peter,
yeah.
How's Peter?
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, it was I won't say it wasn't a walk in the park, but I had a lot of support. I had all of New South Wales sort of reached out. The whole of New South Wales police was fantastic. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I still had to deal with the demons of what occurred and like I said, that palpable, the fear in that moment of when you're 100% sure you're going to lose your life. It stays with you, and you're I suppose I was lucky that I had some really good police come forward with a lot of experience and just mentor you from day one give you those lived experiences and really good advice that and tools that allow you to evolve with that some emotional intelligence like I said, it wasn't a walk in the park. There was, I had plenty of moments where I fell over in the coming years, but it's all the building process to, you know, that resilience and strength that makes you who you are.
And there's something uniquely disturbing about human-on-human conflict. Dave Grossman, who's written a number of books, but one called On Killing, talks a lot about our natural and thankfully quite almost universal aversion to human violence. And there's an interesting thought experiment where, you know, if you imagine a tornado had torn through your house and you know, caused horrific injuries to your family, you would have some grief, but you'd get over it. But if a gang of thugs came in and did the same thing, it would have a far more profound psychological impact. And Grossman talks about proximity of violence as well, and you can't get more intimate than getting stabbed. That must have taken a bit of getting over, Jason.
Yeah, and that last word you use, that intimate. The intimacy of it is the, like I said, I suppose that is one of that's intolerable, you know, the thought of someone having especially planned and actually executed, you know, an act of violence on you, knowing that it would most likely kill you.
What happened to Murray Hearn?
Well, this is, things have changed, I would like to think, but once he went to court in the late 90s, Murray was sentenced to, I believe it was about 26 years imprisonment at the time, which is still not enough for a deliberate and calculated attack on police.
Yeah.
Which related in, you know, someone's lost their life over it. Due to his age and, you know, let's be blunt, a judiciary that's out of touch with what the expectations of their community are, they watered it down so that, you know, I think he ended up with about 22 years on the top, as they say, to 16 or 18 years imprisonment minimum served. So you're talking about murdering someone and you know, only being sentenced to 16 years if you've got good behaviour in prison. And, you know, you have to take into account what it means to murder someone as well. When you murder someone, if that person was ever going to be having children, you've just killed those, you know, whatever was going to happen with that person has now been erased from history. You know, so later in life, once, you know, I was a single guy at the time, later in life when I get married and I have two children, it hit me again quite forcefully actually when I, one of the memorials came around, I realized, hey, if I'd actually passed away here, it would have killed, my kids wouldn't be here. So, you know, like I'm not sure that this is taken into account to the level it should, you know, when someone's life's extinguished like that, because, you know, you're talking about the potential future loss of life as well. So,
and I think to our earlier point as well, the fact that it was an attack on police, that,
yeah,
you know, these are who we entrust. And talking about Grossman before, he talks about sort of the wolves. Like most of society are sheep, there are a few of these wolves out there that'll do us harm. And then you need these sheepdog, these people who are going to stand up to violence and not walk past something that's scary or confronting. And, yeah, we want to have mechanisms that safeguard and disincentivize attacks on police.
Yeah. Mm. Yes.
And tragically, he also created a widow and two kids without a dad. Did you attend Murray Hearn's court case?
I did, yeah. The prosecution at the time were able to get a guilty plea out of him for Peter's murder. So the duration that would have occurred for the court case was substantially reduced, you know, where we still gave evidence and we were all commended actually for the level of evidence we gave in something that was so severe. But yeah, obviously a lot of answers that Pete's widow Jackie was really keen to get insight into were then locked away because he doesn't have to give evidence. He doesn't even have to say anything at all.
Mm.
You know,
what was it like confronting him in court?
Yeah, it's for me, I was a little bit empowered by it because it was like, you know, I'm still standing here. You did your best, and everything I say from this point forward is assisting in burying you in terms of how much time you do in prison. So for me, it was had to be, no matter how I felt, that you had to show that stoicism that's required and no weakness, because I just didn't want to give any satisfaction that you know, such a weak act had any effect on me whatsoever, even though quite clearly it would have. I just didn't want to share that with the offender. So, you know, anything where victims are in the same proximity as their offenders, you know, it's quite confronting. For me, it was more, I really wanted him to see what a real man was as opposed to what he was pretending to be as a, you know, an adult.
It's interesting you speak about stoicism, Jason. We've spoken about that in previous episodes, and I think this is a classic example of that idea that the Stoics talk about, that life isn't fair, it doesn't make sense. There's no rhyme or reason as to why a guy like that should have ended a person like Peter's life. But these things happen, and your ability to deal with that and get on is very commendable.
What would your advice be to people who are trying to make their way through trauma and loss and confront demons in the same way that you have? What would your advice be to them, Jason?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things when you give advice out on this topic. It's for me, you know, a lot of people have their own opinions. There's so much rhetoric out there now on you know, what's effective. But at the end of the day, you have one choice, and that is to put one foot in front of the other and keep moving forward. Because the one thing you don't get back in this time on this planet is time. So, you know, put one foot in front of the other, keep moving forward. Look for the positive aspects of everything in your life. You know, like at the end of the day, what happened to me is like horrific, and people talk to me, oh, I don't know how you got over it. And I actually say to people, it's actually not the most horrific thing that's happened to me in my life. And then they're shocked when I say it. You know, it's like, that's not the worst thing that happened. But you put one foot in front of the other, and it's not always easy, and you fail sometimes. But to develop that resilience that you need to keep moving forward, and that resilience you need to, you know, when something occurs, and how you get past it, and how you override whatever sensations that it might cause for you to, you know, potentially quit, or, you know, that, you know, I suppose aspects of mindfulness, whereas it's so powerful in how you can control how you feel, you know, by the simplest, you know, acts of mindfulness in your day-to-day, and just, you know, looking around and just being grateful for every aspect of what this world has around you, good and bad, you know. It's like, yeah, and you could talk about it a fair bit, and I'm sure there's medical practitioners and mental health specialists out there that could structure it far better than I can, but at the end of the day, if I talk to someone who actually face-to-face asked me, you know, they understand that rhetoric of you haven't got a choice. You have to just put one foot in front of the other and keep moving forward and institute some positive strategies in your life. And for me, one thing that I'd always recommend to someone is to have what would I call it? Like a safety person. It doesn't have to be the same person throughout your life, but someone you feel 100% like you can trust with, you know, you call them up, hey, come have a beer or coffee, whatever it is, and sit down and go, you know what? Like, man, I've been struggling. And then tell them, you know, get it out. It's like you bleed a bit of the poison that's in your system out every time you talk about something that's negative in your life. Obviously, you shouldn't give away everything that's, you know, being contained within your brain, especially in some of these critical stress aspects. But you definitely need at least one person that you can lean on, that you can feel comfortable with sharing how you're feeling. And, you know, I've had a few of them over the years, and they're quite varied in who they are. And, you know, obviously guys I've worked with day to day, you know, one of which I, you know, worked with through literally all of my career. I spoke to him today. He was the first person who sent me a message today saying, hey, thinking about you, big boy, big fella, and hope you're having a good day. Didn't call me, just a quick message, you know. If you contain it, it's just pressure. It's like a pressure cooker, you know. You have to bleed that out. Any of the pain or the, whether it's pain or anger, whatever you're exhibiting stress from, you need to get it out.
Mm. I mean, you've been living a full and complete life since the incident, and certainly you've been filling your unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run. How do people get in touch with you, Jason, if they want some advice or to find out some more?
you know, I'm always contactable. I'm on, I'm on literally all the social medias with the LinkedIns and everything like that. I'm always happy to, you know, for people to reach out. You know, it's amazing how one bit of dialogue, how important it can be in another person's life.
Jason, that's really amazing, and thank you for sharing your story with us, but also for offering those last comments about the importance of having that safe person and essentially making yourself open to that to other people. That's really impressive, mate.
Agree. Thanks very much.
No problem at all.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Now to the debrief. Here at the Unforgiving 60, we relentlessly pursue excellence, and so we'd love to get your feedback, any insights you might have, any reflections on what we've discussed. Certainly, if you are or if you know someone who's living a life less ordinary, we'd certainly love to hear from them as well. You can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. Of course, you can also follow us on social media. Just search up Unforgiving60, that's 60, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and give us a like on iTunes. Until next time we talk, we wish you all the best, and we certainly hope that what we've discussed can help you feel your own unforgiving 60s with some quality distance run. Cheers. All you businessmen, politicians, gather around and meet my friend.